From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Art touches the soul because it helps give life meaning. Whether it's on stage, in a gallery, or on the street, we are drawn to art because it conjures a unique kind of togetherness. The works come alive when we're in the same space, feeling the electricity of others as they too react and respond to the in-person experience of being moved by the effort of another human being's hand. I really do believe that. So what happens when we lose that togetherness, when we can't be in the same spaces together to feel that electricity? That's what we're going to explore today. The question, can art help give this world meaning even at a distance? And we're going to start with a curator who believes that the answer might be yes. The Hastings Contemporary Museum in England is closed, of course, but they've found a way for people to still visit the museum. They use a robot.
It looks like an iPad on a Segway, so it looks a little ungainly, but it's very clever.
That's Liz Gilmore, Hastings director. The robot that virtual visitors now use was originally used by Esther Fox, museum trustee and disabled artist. So how does that funny-looking iPad clipped to the top of a telescoping arm rolling around on Segway-like wheels actually work? Well, Liz told us more.
So you log in through a computer, through a link. It's really easy. You just click the link. And suddenly you're transported to our gallery. Some of the poetry of an exhibition, the way it's hung, the pace, the temperature of it, that comes across really well by robots. And if you're driving it, there's complete autonomy. But there's autonomy through conversation and shared experience too. So it's been wonderful in that way that's brought cultures and communities together. So what happens, there's a driver, that could be me, it could be you. And you use those arrow keys on a keyboard, so forward, back, left and right, and you can drive it and you can have five passengers. It's a bit like a virtual golf buggy, that's how I think of it. But all those passengers and driver can talk. The idea is that I can do a tour of our exhibitions or have a conversation and everyone can converse. We set out with the objective of thinking, how do we continue to show the art? And actually, what's rather eclipsed that is the ability of us to have a shared experience, a shared social experience. I think at the time we secured the robot, we weren't really thinking about the profound impact of isolation. How could we? How could we have known? But really what has been incredible is the fact that this robot has been a kind of agent of social cohesion, if I want to glamorize it. But it's been a way of us bringing together people from all over the globe, from all contexts, all experiences, enabling them to connect with art as a talking point. You know, why do we look at art in the first place? We do it to put ourselves together, to make sense of the world. And I think what better time, at this time of great uncertainty, do we need that kind of sense of affirmation and shared experience? I think as the lockdown here and in other places continues, we realise that we have a very different normality to look to the future. I think that technology now will be a core aspect of our activity. I really want to draw and reflect on what we've learned through this project and to share that with others and beyond the shared experience that we're having with everyone, to think about what the future might look like with robotic assistants. When we look at art, not just the shape, colour, form, but it's the way that we might see ourselves. It holds a mirror up to ourselves, and having the opportunity to talk about who we are and how we've got to who we are. That feels incredibly important to our sense of humanity.
That's Liz Gilmore, director of the Hastings Contemporary Museum in England. The museum had its first virtual opening last week of artist and illustrator Quentin Blake, and Liz said it was fabulous, and they are currently working on getting a second robot. So that's one answer to the question, can art help make meaning? And can we find meaning in art from a distance? Let's get another answer, and let's turn to Helen Molesworth. She joins us now from Los Angeles, California. Helen, are robots the future of art in museums? What do you think?
Hi, Mekna. Are robots the future of art in museums? I think they're going to be maybe one future. I think there are lots of futures that we could imagine now for what it's going to mean to look at art either virtually through robots or images or VR. And I also just want to put a stake in the ground. I have no crystal ball. I don't know when we'll be back, but we're going to go back to museums and concerts. Yeah. We're not totally done with that yet. So I think it's also important to remember that the intractability of human life is that we are social beings and we will be social again.
That's right. Well, let me give you your full introduction, Helen, because it's well worth it. Helen Molesworth is currently the curator in residence at Anderson Ranch Arts Center in Snowmass Village, Colorado. She's the former chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles and former chief curator at the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. And Helen, one of the many reasons why I wanted to talk with you about this question of how does art help give meaning in this moment if it's harder for us to extract the meaning from art is because I remember many years ago you walked me through an exhibition that you had put together at the ICA in Boston about art, pop art in the 1980s. And just full disclosure, I don't know if you remember, Helen, but I think I declared to you then that contemporary art always challenged my patience.
Yes, I do remember that, actually.
I suppose that's my polite way of saying I wasn't a fan. But walking through that exhibition with you, first of all, I had a curator by my side. But second of all, being in that space with those works together, in the way that they were put together, you could almost hear the pieces in conversation with each other. And to me, that is how I felt this profound sense of meaning about here's what the artists were trying to say about the tumult of the 1980s. And I understood it much more and felt connected to it in a way that I simply don't think would be possible if I was doing like a Google Museum tour.
Yeah, I know people always say that, and I understand it, of course, to be true. And I think one of the things you were experiencing there, in my humble opinion, is, you know, works of art are, they're beautiful objects, they're beautiful pictures. They contain all the awe of being made by someone else, something that you can't make, and you look at it and you have these sort of profound revelations. And they are also like words. They're like sentences or paragraphs or essays, which is a way of saying works of art. One of the things they're doing is delivering to you the reportings, the findings of the artist in his or her or their investigation of life. And one of the things we do as humans is we compile everyone's findings, our friends, artists, the news, a TV show, and we cobble them together in ourselves to make meaning. And art helps us make meaning of some of the most complex and nonverbal arts of life, love, hope, fear, death, and a great big sum of knowledge and meaning. And so when you're in a museum, what you're seeing is lots of people's contributions to those big ideas all at once.
Well, the other thing that you're experiencing when you're in a museum, and maybe this is just personally important to me, but you're experiencing it with other people. So you have the multiplicity of the contribution of the artists, and you also have the reactions and responses to other viewers. How important is that, Helen?
Well, I think it's really important. I'm a student of Marcel Duchamp, and Duchamp very famously said, "The viewer completes the work." So a work of art, in my mind, is only ever half done. you know, the way artwork comes to have meaning is that we bring to it all of our questions and we enter into a dialogue with it and with others. And it's one of the amazing reasons why art's meaning changes over time, because our collective understanding and interrogation of works of art comes to contribute to a collective interpretation and then a collective understanding of what they mean.
Now,
so we understand Impressionism so much more differently than it was understood in its time.
Yeah. Now, I want to, sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there, Ellen, but I want to assure listeners that we're not going to just limit this conversation to art that might be in a museum. We're going to talk about art in terms of theater as well, and I think stage arts of all kinds. So don't worry about that, folks. We will get to that. But one thing about museum-based art or gallery-based art, the other thing, Helen, is that there's the diversity of it in terms of your physical interaction, physical response to it. I mean, you're talking about Impressionist paintings. Or palette paintings that are on a vast scale, or the three-dimensionalness of a sculpture, or even prints that are actually might be very, very small, but you didn't know that until you saw it in the flesh, so to speak, because everything can be made the same size when you're looking at it on a computer. And I think that really matters, because the artist is being very deliberate in how she or he decides to create their work. We've got about 30 seconds before we have to take a break, or 20 seconds, Helen. Just your quick response. How much does that matter?
Oh, it's 100% important, and it completely matters. And there's no way for us to give up the profundity of the physical encounter between an individual and a work of art, no matter what kind of art it is.
Okay, so I'm going to jump in there, Helen Molesworth. We've got a lot more to talk about. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour about how art helps us make meaning in this moment of physical distancing, and how we usually derive meaning from art in a way that requires us to actually be together in the tumult of the experience of being in a gallery or the quiet hush of a theater. And how can we make that meaning without that togetherness? And to help us through this conversation, I'm joined today by Helen Molesworth. She's curator in residence at Anderson Ranch Art Center, former chief curator at the Museum of Contemporary Art in Los Angeles and the Institute of Contemporary Art in Boston. And Helen, you know, I've been talking a lot about sort of my own experiences in galleries, but I wonder, let me just ask you, what do you miss right now? Now that you can't walk the halls of your favorite cultural institutions?
Well, I have to say what I really miss, because I traffic in contemporary art, which is another way of saying I usually go and look at stuff made by people that I maybe don't know who they are and haven't seen it yet, right? Haven't seen it already, rather. I really miss being confronted with something I can't quite figure out, I don't quite understand, that I don't have words for yet, that I leave the gallery in a bit of a puzzle, maybe irritated. Do I like that? Do I not like that? What do I think about that? And try and figure out, you know, what I think that other person is trying to communicate. I really miss that quality of the unknown, the unexpected.
Can you have a similar experience looking at works online?
I can, but I've, of course, trained myself over the years not to trust any negative reaction I have by looking at something online, right? I've trained myself to believe that the gold standard of interpretation is actually to be with the object in a real space-time continuum. So it's this irony now that perhaps in addition to learning how to wear a mask and wash my hands all the time and not touch my eyes, I might also have to develop some kind of bone for thinking through new work in this, you know, computer interface, the screen matrix.
How can you do that when everything is pressed into sort of an antiseptic digital unreality? How can you do that?
Well, I'm not exactly 100% sure yet. I mean, I think part of it is to understand that the form, that the delivery system, the flat screen, probably benefits some works and not others. Mm-hmm. So I feel like I could still look at photos and paintings. Maybe there's something about dance if it's really well shot and you're watching it in real time. But right now, I wouldn't judge a sculpture. You know what I mean? Like, I'd be really, really careful about sculpture or installation or institutional pieces, you know, pieces that really take on the logic or the meaning of the site that they're in. I'd be pretty circumspect about any kind of judgment there. But I still think even if you don't know how to judge things, whether they're good, bad, better, best, maybe that's an opportunity too. Maybe instead of thinking about what you like and don't like, you can just figure out ways to engage with work more gently in the space of, oh, I wonder what that's about, rather than trying to figure it all out right away, which is, I think, part of the anxiety of the gallery or the museum.
Yeah, good point, actually. There can be anxiety that definitely goes along with that. And so maybe you're calling for us to sort of learn how to puzzle in a new way. So Helen, you just hang on here for a second, because I do want to bring in an artist that works in another genre, if I could put it that way, because perhaps there's no genre that requires the physicality of the experience more than theater. And joining us now is Melinda Lopez. She's an award-winning playwright, performer, and educator, senior lecturer in theater studies at Wellesley College. Her recent works include her adaptation of Yerma, her one-woman play Mala. There's also Back the Night, Becoming Cuba, and Sonia Flew. Melinda Lopez, it's so good to talk to you. Welcome.
Hi. I'm so happy to be here.
So tell me, from the point of view, well, we'll start by having you put your playwright's hat on, and then we'll ask you about your actor's hat. But from with your playwright's hat on, what do you think is missing for now when people can't sit in the seat and watch a play in person?
That's a big topic. You know, when I'm creating work, I'm thinking all the time about the audience experience. I'm thinking all the time about how an actor's voice is going to resonate in the room. How they're going to play in the moment, and that live exchange of energy between an audience member and an actor. Theater, I've always felt like, is a great metaphor for our human existence, in that you have to show up, you have to be there in person, the experience is brief, and when the play is over, it's done. You can't recreate it. And, you know, in terms of our own holding the mirror up, you know, what we're faced with right now is our mortality, kind of on a global scale. And the fact that theater isn't accessible to us right now feels like a prism, of our literal confrontation with the shortness of our own lives, mm-hmm. and the precariousness of our lives. Mm. And I think that great plays ask questions that are universal across the human experience, like, you know, will my life matter? Have I made brave choices? if you look at anything from like King Lear to Hamilton, right, they're all asking those same questions. And having the opportunity to sit in a public space with other people who are experiencing these same emotions and sort of intellectual puzzles and also the joy of the experience of being in a theater. It's hard to translate that to a virtual experience. Of course, we must, and we will, and we are doing that with some success. But as a writer, you know what Helen was saying. I'm trained as a playwright to think about the live experience all the time.
Mm-hmm. You know, when you said the word public, that got me thinking about how one of the reasons why art is so vitally important is that it creates this rare public space where we can have both a collective experience, sitting in a theater, and at the same time experience the vulnerability of your private response to the art as well. There's no divide there. And that's one of the things I think is so compelling about it. And I personally, just speaking for myself, is one of the things I miss the most, because otherwise there's this like clear public-private dividing line that we have now more than ever.
Right. Well, for all of the arts that are meant to be experienced live, the audience member, the individual who's going, you know, make a pilgrimage, right? You have to leave the safety, the relative safety of your home where things are familiar and you have some control over your surroundings, sometimes more than others, but you have to leave that safety and go to a place that is public and where you're surrounded by people who you may not know and risk having a very private experience in public. And, I think some of the best experiences that I have had in the theater have been when I've been profoundly moved, sometimes moved to tears or raucous laughter. I've seen plays where I found it difficult to get up from my seat, and I've been surrounded by people who could not get up from their seat. And there's an incredible kinship that is formed in those moments, where you realize that what I felt was this deeply personal experience is actually shared among all these individuals who I, prior to tonight had no contact with. Mm-hmm. And that's such an affirmation of our shared humanity. And I think that experience also exists with, hearing your favorite band or going to a concert or, the expedition of traveling to see a work of art or a favorite play. There's something about the investment that you make when you leave security and you venture into this space that's a little raw and a little dangerous, and you don't know what will happen.
Yeah. Helen, did you want to respond to what Melinda's saying?
Oh, well, hi, Melinda.
Hi, Helen.
Nice to meet you in this forum. What you said was so beautiful. And I agree with you so much that one of the weirdest things about museums and galleries I've always felt is that they were these huge public places where one went to have very private experiences. And I think that there's something true about that quality of art, that it's always riding this knife's edge between publicness and privateness. And I guess my question is really for us and for everyone is, we know that art has been with human beings since we could stand and grab things. We've been making marks. We've been making public spaces, right? We know from circular burial mounds, right, that we made spaces for people to gather. So art's going to be with us, but maybe what's going to change, and this has changed before historically, is its delivery systems. Mm-hmm. And every time there's a new delivery system, we get panicked about you know, what's going to happen. And we think that the sky's falling. And granted, it kind of feels like the sky's falling right now. I'm not trying to be too cool or anything. But I do think that we might be anyway at the dawn of the 21st century experiencing some real pressures on our traditional delivery systems, yeah. Museums, the theater, the symphony. They were all struggling to varying degrees before this crisis. So I wonder what this crisis can teach us about what some of the new possibilities are, what some things that we can prepare to leave behind and some of the other things that we know we need, we must take with us, and some of the new possibilities that all this technology has shown us.
So that is such an important question, Helen. And I promise you we're going to come back to it. We'll spend quite a bit of the end part of the show talking about it because it's helping us look forward here. But I want to just take a moment because Melinda had mentioned it a little earlier about trying to do theater in our current instance. And so, folks, just listen to this for a second. What do we need to talk about is the latest Apple family play from playwright Richard Nelson. And it was recorded entirely on Zoom. And we have a scene here. And in this scene, Jane, played by Sally Murphy, and Tim, played by Stephen Kunkin, and Richard, played by J.O. Sanders, they are discussing theater in our current moment.
It's going to happen sometime, if not now. People will, again, need to be together sometime.
Well, will big groups of people want to sit tightly together in the same space for a couple of hours? When will that happen again? How long will that take?
Yeah, first call from the audience and who's listening to the play.
Right, he's right.
You lose something like theater and you're basically saying people stay away from each other. So much more than going to a play gets lost.
Those are actors playing characters in Richard Nelson's new latest Apple family play called What Do We Need to Talk About? And Richard Nelson joins us from Rhinebeck, New York. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna.
So first of all, congratulations on the latest Apple family play.
Thank you.
What made you decide that you were going to do it now and in this way?
Well, I think it never was intended to be a replacement for theater or anything like that, because I don't think theater can be replaced in any way but the live experience, as you guess have been talking. It was more as a marker to put down for those of us who work in the theater and live in the theater that we're still here. Mm-hmm. And it was a kind of a hopeful act to say, let's make the most of this. Let's keep working. Let's keep going. Let's fan the embers a little bit to keep them from going out. And that was the ambition. It happened. This is the fifth Apple family play. The first four were done between 2010 and 2013. And each one was set on a very specific date. So there were conversations about a very specific time and place. And this seemed to be a good way of extending the notion or asking ourselves the question about the very nature of what it means to be live.
Yeah.
I think that there's one thing, there's live within the theater with the audience and the actors in the same place at the same time. There's live in that we streamed this play live. The audience who first heard it as it was being done. But there's also another way of being live, and that is the characters in this play are going through much of what the audience is going through at the same time, meaning through this pandemic. And that's another reaching out of a live experience in a different way.
And powerfully so, right? Because art is supposed to be one of those mirrors that helps us see ourselves, perhaps with more clarity than we had before. I cannot think of a better example than a play written that's performed entirely by over Zoom, talking where the characters are talking about the lived experience of being in quarantine. Now, Richard, I understand that after that original live broadcast, if I don't know what the right word is, but broadcast of it in late April. Thereafter, the play was viewed more than 47,000 times across 30 countries.
Another 10,000 this week. It's over 57,000 right now. Yeah.
So could you have had that kind of reach doing it in any other way?
Of course not. It's incredible what it was. Big surprise just to see what it touched and how people wanted to, I think, feel that they're not alone. I think that's the very essence of what theater can be, is trying to, as you say, reflect back their own experience, but know that that experience is not just theirs, but part of a society and a culture.
Well, Richard Nelson and Melinda Lopez and Helen Molesworth, hang on here for just a moment. We'll come back after a really quick break. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
Smart journalism. Fascinating topics. Words that describe CNN's podcast, The Assignment with Audie Cornish.
Last year, the Army missed its recruitment goal. It had 65,000 spots to fill and came up 10,000 short of that target. Why is it so hard to recruit? How's the Pentagon responding? And how are the voices of service members on social media shifting the balance?
Listen to The Assignment with Audie Cornish wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Today, we are talking with a roundtable of great thinkers about art and how art gives us meaning or helps us find meaning in life. We need that more than ever today. But whether or not that's harder now, because we can't be together to experience that art. And I'm joined by Helen Molesworth. She's curator in residence at Anderson Ranch Art Center. Melinda Lopez also joins us. She's an award-winning playwright, performer, and educator, and a senior lecturer in theater studies at Wellesley College. Richard Nelson is also with us. He's an award-winning playwright and director of What Do We Need to Talk About?, which is his latest Apple Family play, which premiered online. And Richard, can I just ask you, what was the experience like for the actors doing the new play?
It was fascinating. You know, we all obviously rehearsed from our own homes. And so we never got in the same room together, although two of them did because they're married. So they were on the same screen. But I think what was one day after like 3 hours of rehearsal, I ended up talking to one of the actors on, she called me on the phone. She said, you know, I really felt I'd been somewhere. I thought I'd been in rehearsal. And I was so stunned when we finished that I was just sitting in my own home. And I said, I felt the same way. We got lost in each other. It was a very good experience. As anyone who's been on Zoom for a long time knows, after 2 or 3 hours, you start to fade.
Yeah.
So it's a different experience than the 8 hours of rehearsal in the rehearsal room. But there was a real serious correspondence to what it's like in the rehearsal room.
Start to fade, Richard, I believe is a very gentle way of putting it. My brain just flat out turns to mush. But Melinda Lopez, now it's time to put your actor's hat on. I'm thinking about Mala, right? Your one woman play where there are times where you're directly talking to the audience, right?
Yes.
There's a very necessary and profound interaction between you and the people who are experiencing that play. Can you imagine doing that without a physical audience?
You know, that play is direct address. Literally the character is speaking to the audience the whole time. So it would be a very lonely experience. As the writer and the performer in that play, and I've performed that show probably over 100 times. I'm keenly aware of how people are sitting and how they're engaged, and if it's too much for them, is it time to get a laugh? Is it time to back off? It's very much a dance, that particular experience, because I am directly communicating with people. We were able to make a film version of the performance, which I had some concerns about, because I was worried that the subject matter is serious and it's intense, although there's a lot of laughs in it. And I was worried that I wouldn't be in the house. But I found that watching the filmed version was actually pretty satisfying. I think that there is a great place where we can live with, we're talking about access. Helen brought up this idea of access and the delivery system. What I love so much about Richard's work, which I was one of the 10,000 this week that watched it, is that you go right to the heart of the experience and you say, we're not pretending this is live. We're not pretending this is theater. We're on Zoom, and the play is written to be done that way. And I just think that's such a brilliant acceptance of where we are, right? You're not pretending that we're somewhere that we're not. We're in the middle of a pandemic, and this is what this artist can do to address that. I just think it's so brilliant. Everyone needs to see it.
Thank you. One of the things we learned in rehearsing it is that each of the first four Apple Family plays are set at a dinner, and people are having conversations over the dinner table. And we realized that Zoom was our dinner table. It was a play in which we were having conversations over Zoom in the same way. And that's very different than a film or television. And what you're talking about, Melinda, I'm sure doing a film of your show, there's ways of, in terms of close-ups and how one edits and all like that, to make a very interesting work. But Zoom, to try to put a play on Zoom, a play written for the stage, is a very hard journey, I think, a very difficult one. Because in Zoom, the Zoom camera or the screen is a participant in the show. You're not like a camera who's overseeing something or something that you can avoid. You are talking at it. It is a participant. And that's a whole different dynamic than anything else. And which is why the play, needed to be written for Zoom and can't be done any other way. It's not a stage play.
Richard, can I just jump in here and ask you a question? How different is it, or what is the difference between writing a play for a Zoom camera versus writing a teleplay for television?
Oh, I mean, it's hugely different. Okay. It's two different animals. Again, it goes to the notion of the Zoom as part of it, that I am talking at Zoom, and people are listening from Zoom. That's spread out in these little boxes of looking at us. In a teleplay, the television camera or the film camera is an observer of a situation, not a participant. And so it's a whole different, completely different concept. Then Zoom has it has huge restrictions, but then if you work at it enough, you find it also has its own little secrets and joys, and you find suddenly the difference of moving forward to the screen just 4 or 5 or 6 inches is a very powerful force in the conversation, and moving sitting back tells a great deal of a story as well.
Right.
So there's much to learn and discover.
So I want to tell all three of you that I'm mindful of the clock here, and there's a really big silver lining I want to explore with all of you. In fact, all three of you have individually brought this up. I started the show at the very top of the hour talking about this sort of like transporting experience I had looking at a French pastel drawing at the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston. And I stand by my assertion that I would not have had that experience had I not been able to see this drawing in person and experience other people's reactions of it. And at the same time, I also realize that I'm one of few people who got to see this thing in person, that most humans, you know, tens of thousands of people right here in Boston, let alone millions across the country, will never be able to have that experience. So you of all three have brought up accessibility. This is one of the greatest, I think, and most vital critiques of art institutions, that they are can be extremely inaccessible. I never saw Hamilton. Who could afford a ticket? So Helen, let me start with you. Could this be one of the silver linings, that the forced distance that we all have right now is actually it's forcing or enforcing the need to find ways to make art connect more people with more art?
Well, I do think that Richard's experience of that great big audience that he never could have had the play been a conventional play presented in our conventional ways is really interesting and telling. And I love this idea of the Zoom is a participant. So I don't think we're going to give up our pilgrimage to art sites, because as Melinda said earlier, there's something really important about leaving the safety, the comfort, the habit and routine of one's daily life and entering another space, excuse me, in which those things are suspended so you can have a different kind of experience. But on the other hand, it doesn't have to be either or. It can be both and. Yeah. I think that, you know, I was recently asked if I wanted to organize an art exhibition on Instagram. And at first I thought, ugh, how paltry, how horrible. And then I realized that if I organized an art exhibition on Instagram, I could play around with Bernini's sculpture, Daphne and Apollo, which sits in Rome in the Borghese collection, and that no one ever in the history of humankind would ever lend me to put in a contemporary art exhibition in the United States. And so all of a sudden, there was something that could be done. Just like Richard is saying, that there's some new opening happens, and you retool your skill set for that new delivery system. And part of what that system offers is a hugely expanded, potentially more democratic audience. And so how do we incorporate some of that into our thinking and really work the differences rather than trying to, quote unquote, get back to normal? You know, maybe this is the moment where we can acknowledge that normal only had certain virtues and lots of vices.
Helen, did you do the exhibition on?
It hasn't gone, quote unquote, live yet. But it will in the next few weeks, and it's kind of an amazing exercise.
Can you give us just a tiny preview? Like, what did you juxtapose the Bernini against?
Well, I juxtaposed the Bernini against a group of contemporary artists who were thinking about the natural world through the image and metaphor of the tree. And for viewers who don't know, Daphne and Apollo is chasing Daphne, and the moment he touches her, she begins to turn into a laurel tree. And Bernini captures this incredibly violent, gorgeous, ecstatic moment, and her hands are beginning to turn into branches. And I juxtapose the detail of the photograph of the Bernini sculpture, so already not seeing the Bernini live, right? Next to a photograph taken by a contemporary artist. And when I showed the juxtaposition to my wife, she gasped, because we never would have been able to see that comparison outside of all of this screen mediation of our quote unquote real experience. And maybe that's the thing to talk about. When we're sitting in front of a screen, we're still us. We're still having a live experience.
Yeah. to hear her gasp gives me a lot of hope, right? Because that's the kind of response that in the best circumstances art should provoke in us. Melinda, when Helen said both and, I heard you sort of were you virtually nodding in affirmation there?
Yes, I'm very fond of that sculpture as well. My question about the new vectors is that right now we are certainly in a kind of a honeymoon period where we're being very free and easy with access. We still have cultural houses and institutions that are employing, you know, thousands and thousands of people, artisans in the theater who build costumes and sets, and I wonder about access and if there will be a period of, you know, an attempt to monetize this kind of Zoom experience. I can see a darker place where, you know, the live experience is just going to be for the super rich. Or what are the ways that in this period of time we can try to protect the democratization of access to theater and the visual arts? Those are the questions I have. You know, I feel there's so many members of our community who are suffering, with this. They're out of work.
Right.
So many people go into making a play or a production in a theater happen.
Well, I really take your point to heart, Melinda, because, for example, so many community theaters were already barely hanging on and having to shutter their doors, even if temporarily, it's going to make it really hard to come back from. But Richard, we've got about a minute left, and I just wanted to hear from you and your final thought about, sure, is there a silver lining here?
Well, I think there is. I think, you know, what Melinda just said, it was really, really true. But I spoke to a class at Hunter College the other day on Zoom, and I made the point that right now there's going to be a great opportunity for young people coming into the theater, I think, because there's going to be a lot of voids. Very expensive productions are going to be less likely. More fly-by-night works or efforts will be appreciated and given space. I think we in the theater are resilient, and we will find our way back, and we will find our way in different ways back. And there'll be voids to be filled, and that always gives us new life and new breath.
Yeah, I would say there are always voids in human life, and art helps us fill it. So I cannot thank the three of you enough for joining me this hour to think our way through this. Richard Nelson, award-winning playwright and director of What Do We Need to Talk About, which is streaming free on the Public Theater's website and YouTube channel. We've got links to that at onpointradio.org. Richard, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And Melinda Lopez, award-winning playwright, performer, and educator, senior lecturer in theater studies at Wellesley College. Melinda, it's so great to talk with you again. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Magna.
And Helen Molesworth, curator in residence at Anderson Ranch Arts Center. Helen, it's fantastic to talk with you again. Thank you.
Thanks, Magna.
I'm Magna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.